Yes. Mr. Davis?
Yes. May it please the court, again, I'm Brian Davis, representing Mr. James Lachulis. Your Honor, I've asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is an appeal from a FERC decision terminating Mr. Lachulis' license for a small hydroelectric project in Lowell, Massachusetts, based on the theory of implied surrender. The core issue, really, in this matter is that this is not an appropriate case for the application of the implied surrender doctrine by FERC. Prior to this case, FERC consistently ruled that a license would only be terminated based upon the theory of implied surrender, where the licensee has clearly indicated an intent to abandon the project. And in that regard, I would direct the court's attention to FERC's decision in the Montana Power Company case, a 1993 case cited in our papers. And in that decision, FERC was asked by the petitioner to specifically spell out when FERC would terminate a license based upon implied surrender. And FERC said, the implied surrender provisions of Article 30 are invoked only when the licensee, by its actions or inactions, has clearly indicated its intent to abandon the project, but has not filed a surrender application with the commission.
But what do you do with the language from fourth branch that, and so forth, that if he persistently fails to meet his obligations? He certainly did that here.
Your Honor,
he went through, I don't know how many, a dozen deadlines that FERC imposed and never responded. I mean, they had incredible patience.
Well, there are several points in there, okay. Your Honor, that I'll address. First, the fourth branch case, that was not a case in which that case involved two licensees, one of which was offering to surrender, okay, the license. And it was an intractable dispute between two co-licensees that couldn't be resolved, it appears, by any other way. That was not the case, and that's never been the case here, where Mr. Lachulis said that he was willing to surrender his license. Okay, and you go back through the history of this case. Yes, I'm not here to say that Mr. Lachulis was the most responsive licensee that FERC has ever encountered. He did respond.
That's not exactly the standard.
No, you're right, Your Honor. That is not the standard, not for implied surrender either.
Let me ask you, your own reliance on Montana defeats your case, doesn't it? I mean, in the sense that FERC can look at his actions
and
what's happened over this 14-year period,
well, I think
regardless
of
what he says.
I believe, Your Honor, as we stated in our papers, it's not some subjective weighing by FERC of whether they think he sort of crossed the line. It's a question of whether, according to Montana, whether he has demonstrated a clear intent to surrender.
So can we say that it's arbitrary and capricious for them to conclude that given the continual failures to either respond or to come up with the plans, that that indicates clear intent?
Your Honor, he did respond. So in the face of the responses that he filed and in the face of—
that he didn't respond all the time.
He did not respond.
You agree that he missed many deadlines.
He did miss deadlines.
So why can't they conclude that that indicates a clear intent?
Because that's not what the implied surrender doctrine is intended to address.
All you've read is a phrase. You haven't read anything more than that. You've read what you regard as the standard, which is clear intent.
But
that's all you've told us.
The standard that FERC has applied in the past, and FERC has misapplied that standard in this circumstance.
If all you have is two words, clear and clearly intended, mm-hmm. how can we say it's arbitrary and capricious to conclude under these circumstances that the behavior of your client show that he clearly intended? Why is that inconsistent with any previous case?
Your Honor, here there is no prior decision that we've been able to find where the licensee, okay, a sole licensee, said, I do not wish to surrender. I wish to retain the license.
But they've never said that this turns on the licensee saying something like that, have they?
No, you're right, Your Honor.
So yes, this will be the first time in which they hold a situation where the client basically didn't admit that he had abandoned. But there's nothing in the rule that says that there has to be an admission. Because if there were, the rule wouldn't be written as it reads, which is, or shall discontinue good faith operation of the project for a period of 3 years, the commission will deem it to be, the word deem, it to be the intent of the licensee to surrender. So obviously the licensee doesn't have to say he intends to surrender.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree the licensee doesn't have to say that he intends to surrender. However, for example, there are certain situations where the licensee cannot be found. And in the Montana Power case, that's one of the examples that...
So that would be another example.
Your argument basically is that given the mitigating circumstances, this was an arbitrary and capricious application of implied surrender, where there was evidence that there were events beyond your client's control.
That is part of our argument, yes, Your Honor.
Based on our questions, you can see where we're having...
I see, Your
Honor.
...perhaps
having some difficulty, so I'm trying to think of, well, what's your strongest argument? And FERC said it wasn't persuaded.
What I would point out, Your Honor, is in the Montana Power case,
yeah,
as citation for FERC's clear intent test, they cite the Federal Power Act, Section 6 of the Federal Power Act, which provides that licenses may be surrendered only upon mutual agreement between the licensee and the commission.
But that would be, if that were the rule, that would be inconsistent with the face of their own rule. So that can't be the rule. That would mean that they have a regulation, 6.4, which they are going to completely disregard the text.
Your Honor, that's what Section 6 of the Federal Power Act says.
But they don't say they're limited to that. They just cite that as an example of a case.
No, Your Honor. This is footnote 40, yeah, of the Montana Power case,
yeah,
which is the footnote that immediately follows FERC's citation of the clear intent standard.
Yeah.
And it says it's citing Section 6 of the Federal Power Act, the actual statutory language, which provides in part that a license may be, quote, surrendered only upon mutual agreement between the licensee and the commission after 30 days public notice. That's what the statute says. So again, the clear intent standard that FERC has applied in the past and has never varied from, okay, as we can tell, except in this case, because in this case, Mr. Lachulis clearly stated many times over he did not intend to surrender this license.
Well, let me just ask. Imagine that he never did anything, ever.
Yes.
But he says, I don't intend to surrender. There's no mutual agreement here. I just don't intend to. Sorry.
Yes.
That would be, they couldn't take the license.
Oh, no, Your Honor, they could.
Why?
Under Section 31. That's Section 31 of the Federal Power Act provides that FERC can issue an order of compliance, which, again, you know, given the description of Mr. Lachulis' conduct in FERC's
case, couldn't do it by implied surrender.
Couldn't do it by implied surrender, correct.
Right. So you're saying there is no such thing as implied surrender because, I mean, the word implied means implied as compared to express. So you're saying notwithstanding a provision called implied surrender, that they can't have such a provision. Isn't that what you're saying?
The good news, Your Honor, is I don't have to go that far for purposes of this argument.
Well, you are making that argument.
No, I'm not. I disagree, Your Honor, in that, for example, again, FERC cites instances where, you know, cases in footnote 41 of the Montana Power case, where implied surrender has been found in the past. For example, where the licensee has sold the project without prior commission approval and then has dissolved as a corporate entity.
Oh.
I think it's fair in those circumstances for FERC to determine that there has been a clear intent to abandon the project.
Even without mutual agreement.
Your Honor, I would say that implies an agreement on the part of the licensee to abandon the project. It is quite a different circumstance from what we have here, where, as Judge Rogers pointed out, there are a series of mitigating circumstances. Mr. Lachulis, he may not have been the most responsive licensee, but he did respond. He did keep FERC generally informed as to what was happening at the project site. He was working at the project site. The Appleton Mill project is an enormous, old textile mill complex. The hydroelectric project is in the middle of the complex. There was a fire in 97 in part of the complex. There was major selective demolition work. Two-thirds of the project of the Appleton Mill site actually had to be demolition. That work took place over a several-year period. There was remediation work that had to be done at the site. The documentation of this work is contained in the record. Mr. Lachulis generally kept FERC apprised of that. FERC never issued a compliance order to Mr. Lachulis, as it could have.
What do you do with FERC's case in John C. Jones.
Your Honor, that's another case in which the licensee was seeking to surrender the license. Mr. Jones was the one who sought to turn his project over to FERC in those circumstances, and he only later on backed away from that position only slightly when it became apparent he was going to have to pay out of his pocket to dismantle the dam that was at issue there.
Yeah.
And so, but it's very clear in that decision. In fact, it's stated several times over that Mr. Jones, the licensee, his intent was to surrender. He wanted to walk away from the project.
I thought the point was the agency said the key is whether or not the licensee has complied with the license terms, the terms of the license.
Your Honor, that's not the key. That's a factor, it seems to me, in the general determination. But again, when you're talking about implied surrender, that doctrine exists, and again, according to the Montana Power case, it exists to fill that void where, for example, the licensee is completely non-responsive, cannot be located. Now, addressing Judge Garland's...
I want to ask you, are you challenging this standard Article 16 of the license? Are you challenging the Regulation 6.4 that provides that it is deemed to be the intent of the licensee to surrender, deemed to be if it abandons it for a period of 3 years? You're not challenging those. When you said that Article 6 of the FPA says this is the only way you can do it unless, I mean, there's a clear intent by the licensee. This says there's another way you can do it. If he abandons it for 3 years, it's deemed to be implied surrender. You're not challenging Article 16 or the regs, are you?
I'm not challenging Article 16, Your Honor. I'm challenging the application in this circumstance given prior FERC precedent.
You're saying that he didn't abandon it.
We're saying he didn't abandon. He didn't demonstrate a clear intent, which was the standard that existed up to the time that FERC issued the termination order in this case.
No, I'm asking you, the commission in its discretion, after notice and opportunity for hearing, may also agree to the surrender of the license when the commission deems it to be the intent of the licensee to surrender the license. And under the regs, one way they can deem the intent of the licensee to surrender the license is if he abandons it for a period of 3 years.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree that that's what it says.
And right, what is it that is missing here, that he didn't abandon it for 3 years?
No, that he didn't abandon it for 3 years, Your Honor. Again, the application of that regulation is what FERC is explaining in the Montana Power case. And they say that application of that regulation will only be applied in cases where there is a clear demonstration of intent to abandon by the licensee, which does not exist here.
But, you know, in Montana, the commission goes on to say, after that very sentence you're talking about, that the commission has only rarely had to resort to implied surrender procedure to address a licensee's failure to live up to the obligations of the license, citing that footnote.
Correct.
41. In almost all cases, they can get compliance. So I don't know that the agency has signaled quite what you're saying.
Well, actually, if you read on, Your Honor, then it says, when warranted,
okay,
the commission uses its broad authority under Sections 31 and 309 of the FPA to impose civil penalties or to take other actions.
But it's not imposing an exhaustion requirement on itself.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But again,
it's just saying we have all these tools at our disposal.
They have tools at their disposal, but they're supposed to use them in a rational and consistent manner. That's not what happened here.
Well, if you look at the chronology of what happened here, I mean, Judge Henderson pointed out all the times he failed to respond, all the times he failed to respond timely. And then even when he responded, he set schedules that he did not comply with. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, he was working on the site. The answer is yes, okay, number one. Okay. So I'm not...
Yes.
Yes, that he set schedules that he did not comply with. Mm-hmm. But, okay, as I mentioned before, he was not abandoning the property. He was on the property all the time. Okay, he was doing other work on the property that was necessary ultimately to return the project to operation. Okay. Now, if FERC, again, had thought that his noncompliance okay, as described by FERC, was so egregious, FERC could have issued a compliance order to Mr. Lachulis that would have given him the opportunity to comply, that would have given him an evidentiary hearing, which was denied in this case.
Well, in fairness, though, they did write all these letters to him.
But those are not compliance orders.
September 5th, 2003, he was in violation of the statute. In 2004, that the agency considered it abandoned because of failure to operate for several years. And then when your client came back in December with a written response, he promised to provide an outline of work by March of 2005, and the agency says he never did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. The chronology, as stated, shows both they showed letters by FERC, inquiries by FERC. Those are not compliance orders.
No, I understand, but I don't see any statement by the agency that it is always going to do what it can short of giving this type of notice. In other words, it doesn't always have to issue in a compliance order. He's been told all these various times. He's given warning letters. He's told that he was in violation.
And on September 23rd of 04, FERC tells him, since you have not made the necessary repairs to resume operations and the project has not operated regularly since November of 1994, we consider the project to be abandoned. It's your intent to surrender your license, and the commission may terminate your license under implied surrender proceeding. Okay, your client writes back and apologizes and says he will develop a full scope of work by early March 2005. Never submitted that information.
Your Honor, he was working on the property all the time to do the demolition work. The remediation, for example, the asbestos remediation.
Well, he may have been, but, yeah. You know, here's FERC asking for, this license isn't something that he's entitled to without conditions and without obeying the orders, requests, whatever, from FERC. And he said, and FERC tells him, you haven't had this in operation, you haven't responded, and he says, I'm sorry, I'll have this. And once again, he doesn't do anything.
Your Honor, again, this, the distinction I'm making is there are two paths that FERC could pursue here. They could pursue the implied surrender path, which, again, based on their prior precedent, requires that clear expression of intent. When Mr. Lachulis said, I don't wish to abandon, then FERC had other options, which are under Section 31.
Why didn't your client, when the commission puts him on notice, may terminate your license under an implied surrender proceeding, why didn't he say, you can't do that. You can only do that if I don't comply because I have this clear intent.
Well, actually, the way it worked, Your Honor, is FERC actually instituted an implied surrender proceeding. Okay?
So, but not right away, because according to, I mean, your client said, I apologize, I'll give you a new update in March of 05, and he didn't do that.
No, Your Honor, there are, the answer is, again, Mr. Lachulis was responsive. He didn't respond to every inquiry that he received from FERC. He did not receive compliance orders. Perhaps if he had received a compliance order, it would have been a different story. There are some other points I'd like to address, if I may, briefly.
I just ask one last question. This
Certainly.
Point that you made about the footnote in Montana.
Yes.
I can't find this in your brief anywhere.
You can't find the reference to the footnote or Montana?
No. Montana I can find, and yes. Again, the reference to clear intent I can find, but the citation to Section 6 and the suggestion that that's what Montana is about, that I don't find, and that's
I don't
why
think I'm, we specifically referenced that in our brief, Your Honor. It
is. Don't make the argument, for example, that Montana stands for the proposition that there has to be mutual agreement.
No, Your Honor. I was pointing out that that's where the language in Montana, that's what FERC cited as the basis for its clear intent, and I think it's consistent with the language of the statute.
All I'm saying is that point is not in the brief.
It's not in the brief, Your Honor. That point alone.
Let me just ask one quick question. You said that if a compliance order had been issued, the response might have been different. Now, your client is also saying that he was entitled to an evidentiary hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what is it that he would have presented at the evidentiary hearing that he was unable to present in his pleadings?
Well, this court has held in the Pacific Gas and Electric case 2002 decision that if there are questions of intent, an evidentiary hearing is required. The core issue in this matter was a question of intent, whether Mr. Lachulis intended to abandon this property and this project. So it, given that standard, okay, which is quite clear, and FERC doesn't dispute that in its papers, hasn't cited any cases to the contrary, that should have triggered an evidentiary hearing, which Mr. Lachulis repeatedly requested.
As Judge Henderson pointed out in her questions, the regulations talk about deeming. So it's not intent in the question of the subjective intent of the licensee.
And similarly, the title is implied. So again, to support what Judge Rogers said, that sounds objective, not subjective.
Again, Your Honor, the case law is where there is a question of intent, and the case law is not specific whether it's to implied intent or subjective intent, simply a matter of intent. Certainly, Mr. Lachulis offered up a substantial amount of evidence that he was working at the site, that it was not his intention to abandon the project, and that should have triggered an evidentiary hearing in front of FERC. The other point I'd like to make is I'd like to address the ex parte communications,
right,
if I can briefly. There are ex parte communications, off-the-record communications made to FERC in the course of this proceeding that still have not been disclosed by FERC. If FERC has characterized them, these are specifically, there was one that has been posted by FERC on the non-decisional record. It's a memorandum that was sent to FERC by Congresswoman Tsongas's office. It specifically states that the purpose of Congresswoman Tsongas's contacts to FERC were to pressure the commission to terminate the license. Then there were subsequent contacts by Congresswoman Tsongas's office. Once FERC was aware that Congresswoman Tsongas's purpose was to convince FERC to terminate the license, then those contacts were not procedural. They cannot be deemed procedural.
Well, when you say when FERC was aware, there was only this office that deals with Congress, isn't that right? And doesn't the record reflect that the decision makers were not aware of this?
No, it doesn't say that, actually, Your Honor. It says that they never reviewed those specific materials. FERC's decision does not say that the commissioners were not made aware of the fact that Congresswoman Tsongas wanted the project license terminated. It does not say that.
What did you just say? Didn't you say they never reviewed?
They never reviewed the specific materials. Okay, that's what FERC says in its papers, and I think it's in its order.
The decision makers never did.
The decision makers reviewed the materials. What they don't say is that they had no knowledge of the inquiries, that they had not been made aware of the inquiries, that they were not aware that Congresswoman Tsongas was
We should interpret to mean read or what? I mean, if they say we've never reviewed what this communication was, what do you think they mean by that?
I mean,
that they
Your
didn't
Honor,
read it?
Perhaps the specific paperwork was not put in front of the commissioners, but I'm sorry, I might read.
I mean, it sounds like to me that you're saying that they carefully said we didn't review it. That doesn't mean, of course, that we didn't know about it, or that we didn't hear about it, or that we didn't. Someone didn't tell us about it, we just didn't read it. I mean, is that what you're contending? That review means something other than they didn't know about it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, Your Honor, I think the natural inclination would be to say that if FERC's commissioners, the decision makers, had no knowledge of any of the ex parte communications, they would have said that. They didn't say that. And again, since we don't have the ex parte communications, since we had no ability to inquire about them, and we still don't have them in violation of FERC rules and regulations, then we're hamstrung in our ability to address them. They're not procedural. They don't qualify as procedural.
Can I ask about that? So you have an email which suggests that there's going to be a call that's going to not be procedural, right?
Yes.
And that email you have.
Yes.
So they with respect to that email, they complied. They produced
Correct.
It to you, right?
Correct.
So they say in footnote 26 that no second call took place, that the second call was procedural, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but that I don't understand in FERC's footnote, because the memo, the email that we're talking about, originated, it is an email attaching the memo. The memo appears to be dated from August 4th. The email calls for Congresswoman Tsongas to place a call to Ms. Schaub right. to put pressure on the commission, and then a call was placed on August 6th.
Yes.
So the call that's referenced in the memo is the call that Congresswoman placed.
I understand. And they say in the memo that during that call, the Congresswoman asked for a status update. All discussions in this call were procedural. Now you're saying that they're lying. That's really all you're saying.
I'm saying is they don't qualify as procedural, Your Honor. Not under FERC regulation.
They say that all she asked for was a status update. Now, you think that she actually pressured.
Your Honor, I know that the memo, okay, that was sent at the same time states that the purpose of the call was to pressure the commission.
I understand that.
Under the FERC's regulations, that if the purpose of any inquiry is...
But that doesn't say that when the call actually occurred, that it did anything other than ask for an update on status.
Again, but I'm going by the definitions of what constitutes a procedural inquiry, Your Honor. According to FERC regulations, okay, a procedural inquiries such as a these are what are exempted. Procedural inquiries such as a request for information relating solely to the status of a proceeding, unless the inquiry states or implies a preference for a particular party or position, or is otherwise intended, directly or indirectly, to address the merits or influence the outcome of the proceeding. The memo firmly establishes that the purpose, the intent of the call, was to influence the proceeding. Therefore, it cannot qualify.
That may have been the intent of the author of the memo.
Yes.
But when FERC later gets the actual call, that's not said. All that's asked is for the update.
But I don't, again, Your Honor, applying FERC's own regulations, that doesn't matter.
Well, we don't know what the intent of the act, we know the intent of the author of the memo. You don't know the intent of the call.
We know the intent of the call. This is a memo to NT, Nikki
asking Sons, NT to do something.
To place a call.
That doesn't mean that NT is going to do that. Imagine you didn't have this memo. How would FERC know what the intent of the call was?
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't know. They did have this memo. They did know the intent of the call. Okay? And this court has held in the PATCO case that where it's close, okay, where it's unclear, it should be treated as ex parte communication. Okay? And
let me ask this. Now they have reflected in their petition for in their decision on rehearing that it was purely procedural. Okay?
Yes.
And we have before us this other piece of paper that you're talking about that says the intent. Now we have to decide whether this so tainted the proceeding that it made a difference, right?
Yes.
Well, now you have all the evidence we have in front of us. What is there to make us think that this call tainted the proceeding, other than that it occurred?
Well, Your Honor, again, that's where I'm hamstrung. I don't have the communications because FERC has never complied with its regulations to disclose
them. I understand that, but FERC is telling you. Now, let's assume that you're correct, that they should have put this on the record. But they are telling us that what happened in the call was just a status update. Now, are you saying they're lying about what actually, not about the intent, but about what actually happened in the call?
Your Honor, I'm saying that that's not enough information to make a determination. FERC gives us the conclusion that these calls were procedural.
Would it not have been enough? Imagine that was all that actually did happen in the call.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have not put in the record something that says, we received a call from Congresswoman Saugus who asked for status on the update on the proceeding, which the acting director provided, and stated that her office would send further information. Would that not be sufficient?
Your Honor, again, if that was represented as the complete substance of all the communications, the summary that's required under FERC regulations, perhaps, but we don't have those summaries. And in addition, there was an email. Okay, that we know was sent.
You have the email.
No, we don't, Your Honor. There was another one on August 18th, okay, that has not been disclosed by FERC. It was never posted by FERC. It's been requested. It was never disclosed. So there was a subsequent, supposedly procedural inquiry, again, from Representative Saugus on August 18th. There was a response by FERC to that, according to FERC's decision on rehearing. We have neither of those.
And they again say that that's procedural?
They again conclude that's procedural.
Again, I'm asking, wouldn't it be sufficient to say that was procedural?
No, it wouldn't. They have to post the email. It's a written communication. It has to be posted. I'd like to see it. Thank you. I'd like to have the opportunity to argue from the email itself. I really would rather not take FERC's word for it in these circumstances. I don't understand why FERC is not complying with this regulation.
We have to conclude FERC's lying.
Your Honor, in a circumstance like this where FERC is clearly required by its own regulations to post these. There is no excuse for FERC not posting that August 18th.
That's a different question, whether there's an excuse or whether the consequence is more than harmless error.
I think the
because the standard for overturning is it has to so taint the proceeding, right?
Yes.
That you couldn't have gotten a fair hearing.
Yes.
So that's a pretty high standard.
Yes. That's the applying the criteria under the, I believe it's the PATCO decision, Your Honor. If you go through those criteria, the gravity of the ex parte communications, these are pretty grave. Okay, this is a congresswoman reaching out to say that she wishes to have the license terminated. It goes directly to the core issue.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, though, the timing of it. Where was FERC in its decision as in the context of this telephone call? And
The call came a few weeks before the decision was issued, Your Honor.
And what
the decision followed not long after the telephone calls and the other inquiries by Congresswoman Saugus.
Okay.
But what preceded? The question is, what preceded the telephone call? Were there not indications from FERC that they thought there was an implied surrender here?
There were no indications one way or the other, Your Honor. Honestly, I mean, the FERC was collecting information.
September 23rd.
Other than the notice that it was seeking to proceed under an implied surrender theory, but there were no intermediate determinations.
In February, they started the environmental assessment.
Yes, they collected information, but we did not know how FERC was going to come out on this until FERC issued its decision on September 18th, 2008.
And this is the congresswoman who represents the city of Lowell.
Correct. She is their representative in every sense of the word.
And when did you ask for the evidentiary hearing?
We asked for an evidentiary hearing at the very beginning, actually when the initial protest, Your Honor, and several times subsequent to that. And in addition, we asked for disclosure of the ex parte communications before FERC issued its initial termination order. That's bypassed in FERC's papers. On September 5th, a request was made for disclosure of the ex parte communications. It was ignored by FERC in its initial termination order.
All right. Let me go back to the thing that before the argument, I thought that because the decision makers were insulated from knowledge, that decided the issue. And you said, no, they've simply said they didn't review this.
Correct.
Now, what is your position, or what leads you to think that was careful construction to leave, other than what you've argued, to leave open, well, they knew about it, they heard about it, someone told them about it, they just didn't review the document?
I'll explain my thinking, Your Honor. First of all, what this proceeding has been about really from the beginning is to terminate Mr. Lachulis' license because the city wants the property to redevelop it for other purposes. So Congresswoman Saugus' involvement in this FERC proceeding is really to push that prospect. She wants Mr. Lachulis.
How do we know that?
Your Honor, because the city itself has made plain it was an intervener in the process.
How do we know what the Congresswoman
Your Honor, I do know the Congresswoman wants the license terminated. That's stated in the memo from her own office. We've got the paper record of that. I do know that.
I thought the pressure was to be, whatever pressure was to be put was to decide it.
No, Your Honor. Actually, if I may read the portion of the memo.
Ahead.
It says, this is the memo to NT, Nikki Saugus, from Kate in her office. It says telling her to place a call to Patricia Schaub, FERC. It says, as a third party not directly involved in the proceeding, the purpose of this call would be to put pressure on the commission to either A, provide an update on the timetable for issuing the order which terminates the license, or B, promptly issue an order which terminates the license. There is no alternative C there, you'll note. Okay, there is no request for a timetable for when the order will come out which refuses to terminate the license. Okay. So what's going on here is that this memo was forwarded to FERC on August 6th.
Okay, but let me stop you because I asked what leads you to believe in the record, and you pointed to that when the decision makers say we did not review the ex parte communication, that they were couching that in very careful terms and left unsaid was we did know about it or we did hear about it or something like that.
Part of my thinking, Your Honor, on that point is that FERC has not been forthcoming with the other communications,
okay,
which they're required under their regulations and which FERC has never adequately explained other than stating, concluding, I think incorrectly under their own regulations that they're procedural. They've never posted that August 18th email,
that
which they're required to do.
Belief, in other words.
They, they haven't earned my faith in this circumstance, Your Honor. Your Honors, again, so if I may, I think that this decision should be vacated. I know I'm over my time. This decision should be vacated. This matter should go back. It was tainted by those communications. It would be a horrible precedent to allow this to go unresolved.
You've gone over your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Davis. Ms. Amberkale.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jennifer Amberkale for the Commission. I'd like to start by answering Judge Henderson's question about the last footnote in the rehearing order. This is JA 703, where the Commission says that it didn't review that none of the Commission members reviewed reviewed the material prior to issuing the termination order, so we could not have been influenced by it. I think you have to read that together. The Commission isn't trying to parse out and say it hadn't heard about this or it hadn't heard that Congresswoman Tsongas was interested in having the license terminated. It's saying that there wasn't any undue influence because the commissioners did not know about this email. I'd also like to correct a misstatement by
Oh, it's a very narrowly parsed footnote. In other words, they may well have known that the congresswoman was calling every other week and sending emails.
They knew she
that
was.
She represented the city of Lowell and wanted this city project to go forward.
They certainly knew that she was filing requests for status reports a lot. And because those were all going in the public record, in the decisional record, they didn't see the August 6th email because that was in the non-decisional record. None of the staff that prepared the order saw or reviewed or heard about the non-decisional, heard about the August 6th email because it was in the non-
It doesn't matter under your explanation because they knew she was calling because she wanted the license terminated. That's what you said.
They knew she was calling for status updates.
Well.
And they knew she's
not saying that they had not heard that the congresswoman was interested in having the license terminated. That's almost a direct quote of what you said.
Well, then I'm
Do you want to correct? What do you want to say here?
I misstated.
Okay. What is the correct way to
The congresswoman at? Was sending letters to the commission asking for status update on this project. And the commissioners knew that she was interested in the project.
Now, why? Because of the request for the status reports that is in the public?
Yes.
All right. I mean, we need to stick to the record.
Yes, the record and
I mean, why you say that the commission knew this and knew that. Say specifically how the commission knew it.
In the record, Your Honor, there are two letters that were mailed to the commission. One in July.
You don't need to go into all that detail.
Okay.
I'm just asking you, the commission members, the decision makers, knew she was inquiring by virtue of the letters going into the public file.
That's correct.
Right.
Two letters going into the public
right.
file.
You then said the staff preparing the order or something didn't know. How do we know that? Because
we know that
smoking gun memo was not in the public file, or what?
The one memo that the commission determined was likely to be an ex parte communication was put in the non-decisional file. So decisional staff did not see that file.
All right.
The commission's files are electronic, just like this court is moving to, and all of the items that come in are classified as decisional or non-decisional. When a staff member wants to see the record upon which that person drafts an order, they go in and they open up the decisional file, and they click on a checkbox that says remove non-decisional items. And so that's the process that decisional staff follows in writing orders, drafting orders.
You have to assume they check the box.
You do, but the commissioners have also said...
Yeah, we presume regularity. That's what you're...
Yes, you do. And I don't think you need to parse out that sentence in footnote 26 in the rehearing order, because the commission says it couldn't have been influenced
by it,
meaning the August 6th email and attached memo.
But they knew the congresswoman representing the city of Lowell was inquiring.
Yes, and she was making procedural status requests by letter and by email. And
but I mean, the commissioners are not naive.
No.
Right? She represents the city that wants the licensee not to continue to have his license. I mean, they know why she's calling.
But the point is that it didn't taint or influence them. As Judge Henderson said, the timing on this is, it's very clear where the commission was heading.
Yeah. Let me ask this. You keep saying that, somebody keeps saying that commission members knew of her interest. Do we know that, or do we know that the staff knew that? In other words, the people drafting this order. And is that... whatever the staff knows, the commission members know. I mean, are there things that the staff members know preparing the order that the commission... I can't imagine the commission sitting down at this electronic file and going over every single thing in the decisional file and seeing these requests for status reports.
The direct answer is we know from the record that the chairman of the commission knew about her non-ex parte procedural status requests, because he signed the letters in response saying what the status was. I would like to follow up also on the allegation that the second email and the August 6th phone call should have been put in the record, that they were ex parte communications. By the Sunshine Act definition and also by the Commission's own rules, 2201C defines, by definition, those were procedural. They were not ex parte or off-the-record communications.
What about opposing counsel's argument that unless the inquiry states or implies a preference or is otherwise intended to influence the outcome? And his argument is that first email indicates an intent to influence the outcome.
But there is a presumption of administrative regularity here, and the commission has summarized those two contacts that didn't go into the record, and it has said...
Well, his argument is it doesn't matter what is said. That is the purpose of bombarding the commission with status inquiry was actually intended to influence the outcome.
You have to understand, Your Honor, this is not any different than the kinds of a number of status requests that the commission gets regularly from members of Congress.
Usually you don't get the talking points attached.
That's true, Your Honor. And that's why the commission put that in in decided it was an ex parte communication and put it in the record. And it followed its regulations in doing that. It followed its regulations and the Sunshine Act in not putting the other two contacts in the record because they were purely procedural.
Could I go back to the issue of FERC's precedent on implied surrender?
Sure.
Do you have any prior cases close to this one where the licensee is on the property and there are extenuating circumstances beyond his control, but there's no abandonment either physically or by written statement by the licensee?
Well, generally in there are two cases that I think are very similar.
All right.
Generally, you don't get a statement by the licensee that they want to abandon.
Okay.
Because they're not, a lot of times they're not around. That's not always the case. You pointed to the two best cases in the commission's order. This is the rehearing order at note 18. Joint Appendix, page 700. It's the John C. Jones and the Fourth Branch Associates. Both of those cases, the licensee expressed an interest in continuing to operate the project.
Right, but as, do you agree with counsel for petitioner's explanation of the Jones case? It's different than this case. I mean, Jones initially wanted to surrender, and then when he found out he was going to have to pay for destruction of the dam, he changed his mind. I mean, it's all I'm trying to get is there any case where the licensee has been on the property but has not been as good as the licensee ought to be about responding to staff requests for status reports. But at least when I went through this chronology, at least up through, let's see, where is it? Even though he had failed to operate and had failed to respond promptly, at least as of October 99, FERC had approved the schedule that he had submitted. Then they inspect and they find the roof had caved in. It was still not operating. And they wrote him at the end of July, and he responded with a progress report. And then he got a letter in March of 03 saying resume by the end of May and file a report by June. And then we have silence, is that correct? Until the September 5th letter? This is in 03.
Yes, until a response to the notice of termination.
Then when he finally responds in December of 04, this is after the letter from FERC saying they consider it abandoned, he comes up with all these statements about the fire, the asbestos, and how this was taking years to clear, and that he had spent over $1 million in this effort to accomplish these things.
$1 million in the clearing of the property and asbestos removal, but that doesn't relate to restoration of the project.
But it doesn't indicate he's walked away.
It indicates he hasn't walked away from the property, but it doesn't say anything about the project because the project was in total disrepair when we inspected, when the commission inspected it.
Well, why is he doing this other stuff? For other reasons? You're saying this $1 million has nothing to do with the project?
I'm saying that nothing in the record shows that it had to do with the project, and the commission also found that nothing in the record showed that the expenditures that he claimed had been actually spent on rehabilitating or restoring the project.
And it was not necessary to clear out the asbestos before restarting the engine.
I think there are some issues of access here, and the commission...
No, I understand after the city of Lowell steps in, but I'm before the city of Lowell.
But I'm talking about during the asbestos abatement. Yeah. There are some access issues. You can't be allowed onto the property. But we don't. The commission doesn't know how long he wasn't allowed onto the property. And the record doesn't... It provides some mixed signals about that.
So the but commission's the, point is it was his burden to provide a more fulsome response when he responded in December?
It was his burden to respond to each of the commission's orders asking for a response by the terms of his license, and it was his burden to keep the commission informed of the status even when the commission didn't ask. He never did that.
Okay, but what the commission tells him in September is it considers the property abandoned because of failure to operate for several years. That's what they tell him. It's not all this business about you've been late in responding and things. But he hasn't operated for several years. And then he comes back and he says, well, look what's been happening during these 7 years.
But he also says it's his plan to understand and develop a full scope of work by early March 2005. And nothing happens, and he never submits that, according to FERC. Did anything happen in 05? Because the next thing that happens in April 06, the city takes the property. What else happened in 05? I mean, what did FERC do?
The commission was not informed of what was happening in 05.
What I mean is when he didn't produce whatever he said he would produce in March of 05, what did the commission next do?
The commission next, I believe...
2 years later.
Was that that March 07?
Two and a half years later, it issued the notice of termination. But there were inspections during that time as well. But the inspections may have been delayed because of access to the site.
So the asbestos removal was still going on in 05?
It's not clear from the record when the asbestos removal was happening.
Well, is it clear from the record with these 05 inspections that they either got on the property or they didn't? In September of 2004, FERC tells him, we consider this project to be abandoned. He buys another 6 months' time. He never responds, and it then takes 2 years?
And then on June 15th of 06, FERC inspected. And then the city's letter came in saying that they had taken the land. And then
I read the record. There were a lot of things going on during this period. There were these meetings with the city. I gather FERC was aware of all of this as well.
No, Your Honor, FERC was not aware of
totally
all of that.
Totally unaware of what the city of Lowell was doing.
That's right. The commission was not informed. Mr. Lachulis didn't have any contact with the commission for a year after the city.
That's different from whether the commission was aware of what the city was interested in doing.
Well, and the city informed FERC of the taking in a letter in July 20th, 06.
Yes,
so
but
they didn't know about it.
But by the terms of his license, Mr. Lachulis is required to provide status reports and did not provide any of those status reports, did not even acknowledge that the city had taken his land for a year after the city informed the commission.
So his other, well, all right, it's an odd case compared to your other implied surrender cases where people walk away from the property.
It is almost a unique case,
yeah.
A one of a kind, but that's because it's so rare for the commission to seek compliance and not get that compliance with its orders. And here, the commission, as Judge Henderson said, was incredibly patient, provided tons of due process to Mr. Lachulis.
I don't know now that I would say patient. I would say they may have dropped the ball as much as this licensee did. But
Can I ask about the property? Is there some issue that he may be using the property for some purpose other than or in addition to the FERC purpose? That is, these asbestos correction, is that for some other purpose?
The property is quite large. I believe the tract that they're redeveloping is 15 acres, and Mr. Lachulis has 7 acres of that. And it has multiple mill buildings on it and tenants in those mill buildings.
He has a property, and he could be, I guess I'm asking, is there some suggestion that he has a motivation to hold on to the FERC license so that it can't be taken, the property can't be taken away and he can use it for something else, even while not using it for the purpose FERC intends?
I guess that's possible.
That's not a suggestion in this at all. So what is it that he's correcting the asbestos on?
The mill building that caught fire.
Not the mill building that generates electricity.
Well, these mill buildings are very unusual in that they share a lot of walls, or they had two mill buildings close to each other and they put a roof over the space in between, and that became a third mill building. So to say it's not part of the project, part of the building where the project is located, I actually think it is one of the walls that encloses the project was one of the walls that burned down.
Okay, thanks.
Judge Rogers? All right, thank you. Let's see, does Mr. Davis have any time? All right, why don't you take a minute?
First, Judge Garland, if I could direct your point. These are contiguous buildings. There was a fire in Building 2A in 1997. The city and Mr. Lachulis worked together, decided that portions of the building should come down really as a fire hazard. And so it required shutting down the entire site so that those parts of the buildings could be demolished.
Sounded like FERC's agreeing with you on that.
And that the asbestos abatement really restricted access to the entire site. And relevant to that point is if your honors would look, I don't think it's in the record appendix, but it is in the record. It's Mr. Lachulis's motion to strike the city's comments on the environmental assessment and request for an inspection, June 6, 2008, that was filed with FERC, page 7. He notes that the certificate of completion of the asbestos abatement work was not filed until July of 2006. So it wasn't filed until after the city had wrested the property from him by eminent domain. A couple other points, if I may briefly. First, PATCO states the possibility that the process was tainted is enough. I don't have to prove, Mr. Lachulis doesn't have to demonstrate that the process was tainted.
Can I ask a follow-up on Judge Garland's question?
Yes.
I think, Judge Garland, were you asking what purpose he would have had for the property other than the project? Yeah. I got the impression, isn't this in a historic site?
It is a historic site, Your Honor, and there are other parts of the property that can be used for other purposes. Mr. Lachulis is interested in recovering the plant, which is a portion of the property, not all of the property. So, and his license, the validity and the continued existence of his license is relevant to his ability to recover the project as defined in the license. If I also just can point out the John C. Jones case, and it specifically states in that decision that in response to questions posed by the field office, Jones stated that he would prefer dam removal as the outcome, and that he had not intended in his 2004 letters to the commission to modify his original application to surrender the project and remove the dam. The John C. Jones case, it's very clear that the licensee wanted to be done with the project. In addition, the last point I'll make, Your Honor, is FERC counsel has indicated there are mixed signals in this record. Okay, there are ambiguities in this record. Mr. Lachulis repeatedly requested an evidentiary hearing so some of those issues could be resolved. The condition of the property, the ability, these mitigating factors, what effect that had on his ability to comply with the license, his ability to present evidence on those points and others was denied by FERC. He did not get the chance of an evidentiary hearing where there are issues of fact, material issues of fact to be resolved. This court previously has held that FERC should have an evidentiary hearing. There are issues of intent here.
Is, what are the issues that he could not present in his pleadings, as distinct from what he says he has to present at an evidentiary hearing?
For example, Your Honor, in its decision, FERC indicates that the condition of the property means that it is unlikely to be resolved, to be returned to operation. Mr. Lachulis could have offered the testimony of witnesses, for example, Mr.
Why couldn't that be done on the paper, I think, is the question Judge Rogers is asking. That is, this statute is not like others, which say that if there is a genuine issue of material fact, there has to be a hearing. This is one that says there has to be such an issue that can't be resolved on the papers, right?
Well, actually, I think the case law, Your Honor, is that where there's a genuine issue of material fact, there should be an evidentiary hearing. It's not required, but there should be one. So the presumption should be for
that. That is the case under others. I kind of looked pretty closely at this. I didn't see any. I understand your point about intent. That would suggest that where demeanor evidence matters, it makes a difference. But
I'm looking at, for example, the Cajun Electric Power Cooperative case versus FERC. Your Honor, I believe that that case indicated that FERC is typically supposed to conduct an evidentiary hearing when there are genuine issues of material fact to be resolved. It goes to the biggest point that couldn't be resolved by way of a paper hearing really goes to Mr. Lachulis' intent, his explanation for why he didn't act, the circumstances surrounding the passage of time here. This is a matter that should have been heard.
So, for example, the Cajun Electric case says, in general, FERC must hold an evidentiary hearing only when a genuine issue of material fact exists, and even then, FERC need not conduct such a hearing if the disputed issues may be adequately resolved on the written record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mere allegations of disputed fact are insufficient to mandate a hearing. So the only real question is why, other than demeanor testimony, I'm not seeing why the demeanor testimony is relevant here. Why all the things you talk about, that is the efforts at asbestos removal, all those other things couldn't be done on the paper.
Your Honor, certainly it'd be done much better by way of an evidentiary hearing, number one. Number two is, since the core issue
Why better?
Because
an affidavit saying all the things you said. Why is it better in a hearing?
Your Honor,
and besides, whether it's better isn't really the issue. The issue is whether it has to be. That's the only way it can be resolved.
If I may, Your Honor, going back to the issue of intent, which is the core issue to be resolved here, it seems to me, again, the case law is quite clear. Where there is an issue of intent, there ought to be an evidentiary hearing. The better determination here and what the law requires would be that if they're going to terminate this license because Mr. Lachulis had a clear intent, again, that's what the standard was before this case, a clear intent to abandon, then certainly Mr. Lachulis's testimony on that point, what his intent was, and weighing the credibility of his testimony is something that FERC should have done here. That's what the case law would seem to require. That would have been appropriate. It would not have been difficult for FERC to do it in these circumstances. And that's what, for example, if they had gone by way of Section 31, which FERC suggested in its papers it could, he would have been entitled to that evidentiary hearing. That's what Section 31 requires. But by going the implied surrender route, FERC bypasses those protections. And applying implied surrender in these circumstances, which Your Honors have pointed out, very unique circumstances, they bypassed all those protections that he otherwise would be entitled to.
Can I ask just one question I'm interested in, and that is how much power would this project generate? I mean, what are we actually talking about?
We're talking about, Your Honor, it's approximately a 350-kilowatt generating facility currently. It could be expanded, subject to FERC approval, about 350 homes in New England, give or take. Annual power consumption, so not insignificant. And FERC made a point, I think, in its papers that he didn't have a power contract. He could get approval to sell this into the market. I mean, there was no impediment on account of the fact that he didn't have a power contract at that point in time.
All right, thank you,
Your Honors.
Stand, please.